Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I have to apologize. It's two shows in a row where we've been so engrossed that we've been unable to kind of bring everybody else, you know, into, oh, shoot, we're at least Paul, just so you understand, folks, Paul is doing this remotely, and we're kind of doing this over point-to-point communications. And so when we're talking, if I don't see how much time is remaining, and sometimes I, you know, I think we got time, and next thing you know, we're going into break or the show's ending. And so I'll have to be a little bit more vigilant. I apologize, Paul, for having to just abruptly cut you off. But anywho,
I'm okay. We just get engaged, and it's the timer on the show that cuts us off, and then
right,
yeah. I just don't realize what's happening.
Yeah, our conversations can't end on their own volition because they're timed. So anywho, we're still in the South Dakota South Carolina. Still got South Dakota on my mind. We're still in the South Dakota debates, and we are still on Wednesday. All of these statements are on Wednesday, the 16th of January. And so this is the last comment that is we're going to read for the 16th, and then we'll migrate into the 17th. And this now, is by this is, Mr. Rutledge.
Right. So where did I leave off? On this, we were talking about slaves.
So, actually, just go ahead. Gentlemen should carry. Just start it off from the top.
Okay. Gentlemen should carry.
Are you there? Whoa, so we have a connection problem, folks. Hold on a quick second while we... Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm not muted.
Okay, so we actually had a connection problem. Something happened. Okay, so go ahead and pick it up with Gentlemen Should Carry again. Thank you so much.
All right, here we go. Gentlemen should carry their views into futurity and not confine themselves to the narrow limits of a day when contemplating a subject of such vast importance. The gentleman had complained of the inequality of the taxes between the northern and southern states, that $10 a head was imposed on the importation of Negroes, and that those Negroes were afterwards taxed. To this, it was answered that the $10 per head was an equivalent to the 5% on imported articles. And as to their being afterwards taxed, the advantage is on our side, or at least not against us. In the northern states, the labor is performed by white people. In the southern, by black. All the free people, and there are a few others, in the northern states are to be taxed by the new constitution, whereas only the free people and two-fifths of the slaves in the southern states are to be rated in the apportioning of taxes. But the principal objection is that no duties are laid on shipping, that in fact the carrying trade was to be vested in a great measure in the Americans, that the shipbuilding business was principally carried on in the northern states.
Okay.
Chair, what is he saying here?
I'm sorry?
I said, G.R., what is he saying here?
So he's really,
it sounds like
he's just associating how the taxation is going to be and how the three-fifths is kind of implied into this. And when we get a little further down, you're going to kind of see how it, because some people had the opinion that South Carolina, I was going to say South Dakota, was going to carry a greater burden and not be able to pay. So just keep in mind that the people that use slaves and the people that become pretentious tend to be greedy. And so, you know, what is this going to cost me was one of those conversations.
Okay.
And so, in other words, you know, many of the things that they were looking at had more to do with, you know, their perceived loss of value, the threat to their world, you know, their financial world as they see it, because that's what it all kind of encompassed, right? So as we go through this, you'll realize that how small both Georgia and South Carolina were in population.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
All right, sure.
So we're going to jump down to Coatsworth Pinckney, and he's going to talk about treaties, and this is on Thursday, the 17th.
Okay. Here you go. The treaties entered into by Congress are not to be held in the same sacred light in America. What foreign nation will have any confidence in us? Shall we not be stigmatized as a faithless, unworthy people if each member of the Union may, with impunity, violate the engagements entered into by the federal government? Who will confide in us? Who will treat with us if our practice should be conformable to this doctrine? Have we not been deceiving all nations by holding forth to the world in the ninth article of the old Confederation that Congress may make treaties if we at the same time entertain this improper tenet that each state may violate them? I contend that the article in the new Constitution, which says that treaties shall be paramount to the laws of the land, is only declaratory of what treaties were, in fact, under the old compact. They were as much the law of the land under that confederation as they are under this Constitution, and we shall be unworthy to be ranked among civilized nations if we do not consider treaties in this view. Vattel, one of the best writers in the Law of Nations, says, quote, there would be no more sovereignty, no longer any commerce.
No more security. So
there I'm sorry.
Not sovereignty.
Would be no more security. No longer any commerce between mankind. Did they not believe themselves obliged to preserve their faith and to keep their word? Nations and their conductors ought then to keep their promises and their treaties inviolable. This great truth is acknowledged by all nations. Nothing adds so great a glory to a prince and the nation he governs as the reputation of an inviolable fidelity to his engagements. By this and their bravery, the Swiss have rendered themselves respectable throughout Europe. This national greatness of soul is the source of immortal glory. Upon it is founded the confidence of nations, and it thus becomes a certain instrument of power and splendor, end quote. Surely this doctrine is right. It speaks to the heart. It impresses itself on the feelings of mankind. It convinces us that the tranquility, happiness, and prosperity of the human race depend on inviolably preserving the faith of treaties.
There we go. Feedback? Questions? Make sense?
No. Yep, makes sense. It's, you know, the nations are expected to keep their word just as their word and their honor just as men are.
Right. So to help you avoid a lot of the, I think, French that was coming up in the next comment. I'm not sure if you see, you know, if you would have continued, you'd see this, you know, passage of French and so forth. But anyway, just a little bit further down in the next paragraph, there's a little more pointedness to the treaties.
Sure. By the present Constitution, each state sends two members to the Senate who vote per capita, and the president has power with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the Senate present concur. But this inconvenience attended the old method. It was frequently difficult to obtain a representation from nine states, and if only nine states were present, they must all concur in making a treaty. A single member would frequently prevent the business from being concluded, and if he absented himself, Congress had no power to compel his attendance. This actually happened when a treaty of importance was about to be concluded with the Indians, and several states being satisfied at particular junctures that the nine states present would not concur the sentiments on the subject of a treaty were indifferent whether their members attended or not. But now that the senators vote individually and not the states, each state will be anxious to keep a full representation in the Senate, and the Senate has now power to compel the attendance of its own members.
So there you go. But later on, when we came to the turn of the 20th century, at the end of the 1800s, and the reason why the 17th Amendment was presented was because states weren't sending them. And I believe that these were the corrupt states that were deliberately doing this to invoke the 17th Amendment. But go ahead. He continues on a little bit more. Go ahead.
Hang on. You said, give me just a little background about
the 17th Amendment.
Brought about the 17th Amendment. You say the states weren't sending.
Yeah, so they were having a hard time getting all of the states represented in the Senate. There were seats that were not being filled because the state legislatures, who were corrupt, were deliberately keeping, you know, making their appointments.
What would be the advantage of that?
The outcome. You create the problem, then you now can, introduce the solution. Well, let's bypass the state legislature and let's just go ahead and. And so many of the other states, there was a cooperation between these states, these compromised states, where, you know, the 17th Amendment was a recommendation by the states. Remember, I said most all of our amendments came from the states.
Right.
You know, the federal government didn't just, you know, go into these dark rooms and concoct some amendment. You know, most of them were brainchilds by the progressives but this is just basically speaks to how corrupt the states had become by that point.
Well, what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, the states, I don't know what they think their advantage is and why so many of them did that. When you speak of corrupt, it seems like they had to have had some kind of outside influence to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. They did. Absolutely. The globalists were basically injecting these. I mean, why is it that the governor of New Jersey decided, you know, was one of the first states to decide to sterilize, you know, children that were born, you know, with, you know, disadvantages, whether they be, you know, physical or what have you, mental. And so those children were all sterilized, carte blanche. It was the law that started in New Jersey. Who was the governor of New Jersey at that time that did that?
You talk about Woodrow Wilson.
There you go. So, I mean, you have these people that have been indoctrinated. If you look, I remember reading this list. I forget what book it was, but they had a list of some of the people that were coming back from the Marx School of Economics in Germany. I forget the Frankfurt Economics or something like that. And William D. Du Bois was one. I mean, all of these people that were coming back were basically embracers of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't matter what your racial makeup was, because, I mean, obviously, Du Bois was a black. And so there were people that had that kind of influence that went there, and they all came back with the same sentiments. Yeah, we need to do this.
Hang on a minute. Before you go any further, I'd like some documentation on that, because W.E.B. Du Bois is pretty well respected, even historically now.
Yeah, so go look at his academics. I'm pretty sure it was him, but if you look at where he went to school, you'll probably find that he actually attended a Frankfurt school, and that's where he was introduced into Marxism and Marxist economics.
I'll look that up.
Okay.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Sure. No problem. It wasn't just him. I mean, there were all sorts of people that were coming back. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt himself, when this new theory of economics and law and those types of things hit Harvard, Teddy Roosevelt felt he was sighted. He lost. He didn't get the opportunity because he went there too soon. He was too young. Or too old,
I should say. He felt he was slighted.
Yeah, he felt that what they were teaching in that school, he would have been a better man had he attended during that time, which was later than when he did.
Wow. Okay.
And he was the one that created the Trust Busters and all of these other things. See, when we start looking at, you know, oh, that's so noble and nice that government is doing the protecting the common man. Just understand what that is. The common man is collectivizing people. not individual. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, when we look at the federal government going after corporations unconstitutional, like what Teddy Roosevelt did, that was a huge encroachment in the Constitution. Mm. Anyway, so even though people look at it as, you know, there's a lot of people that just thought that that was a good thing. Absolutely not.
I can tell you why. So imagine, and I think we've discussed this before, that near the end of the 19th century, I think there was a court case involving a railroad, because I believe at one point corporations were not considered legal persons. And so I can understand why this would be popular, because imagine this, you've got a fictitious entity,
yep,
that has, compared to a human being, unlimited resources and an indefinite lifetime. And you wind up fighting one of these things in courts and you never win. I mean, rarely. So I think from the viewpoint of just a regular citizen facing something like that, I can understand why, you know, being a trust buster would make you fairly popular. And I guess it did that for Teddy Roosevelt. You know, still some questions that I've got about that and about how that all worked out and how it's affected the way we are now.
Yeah, and so that backfired with Alcoa. See, when a corporation actually acts badly, all that does, when they start, you know, maintaining, they've got a market, or I should say a control on the market or what have you, all they have done is they've just proven that, you know, they are in that position of control. It opens, what it does is it basically starts creating all sorts of doors and avenues for competition to come in. But what Teddy Roosevelt did was, instead of allowing the market to correct itself, he injected himself as a demigod and saying, I will not, you know, I have power to stop you, and he didn't.
So the market would have corrected itself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The market would have corrected itself, because what would have ended up happening was somebody else would have come to compete, because at that point it was still the wild, wild west. Nobody owned all the resources. Something else could have come up. So imagine this. When a company is caught today being woke, and actually doing something that is vile in the minds or repugnant to the majority of the people or the repugnant to the majority of the consumers, what happens to that company?
Well, I'll tell you what happened to Bud Light.
There you go.
They got financially smacked really hard.
Right. So what ends up happening is, if you really feel that you're that dominant and you start inflicting that, you know, a lot of people will just stop buying your product, or they'll find other means. They'll find another way. It's a principle of the matter, and Americans are principled people. Even in this godless state that the national education indoctrination system has created, as godless as we've ever been, and not that we're all godless, but I mean, we're at, you know, it's only increasing the lack of reverence and the lack of acknowledgement of Christ, then we can see how, you know, even in today's society, we're still principled people.
Okay.
Even those who, you know, drink the beer, because there's a lot of people that just, you know, some people said that this speaks to, you know, this whole transgenderism speaks to this whole tolerance. It's not. It's that the tolerance is that nobody's actually having to take a stand on it. And now you've started permeating into brands and going down that path. Now you actually, boom, you've actually proven that it is not a norm. Does that make sense?
Okay.
No, it didn't make sense to you. Because the uprising of those who buy and drink Budweiser Light, Bud Light, was of such a magnitude that it hurt them. In other words, the majority of their drinkers felt insulted by this decision of using that person as their, you know, avatar, mascot, what have you. There you go.
Yeah. But
anyway, okay. you understand what I'm saying. And sure. if it was truly acceptable, then it would have been no big deal. I remember when they started putting women on Wheaties. That was, you know, I didn't have a problem with it. I was a kid at the time when they, you know, Wheaties had, you know, these images of athletes and so forth. And I'm going, okay, that's great.
Sure.
You know, I didn't, it may have been a sexual revolution or, you know, the war of the sexes outcome, but it wasn't an overreach of morality.
Right.
Right. And I'm just saying that we have not gone as far as they want to get us to believe that, oh, yeah, this is all acceptable now.
Right.
Right. Okay. So okay. The next one is treaties again. It, you know, actually there's a little pause and then we pick it up again. Now let us consider.
Yeah. Okay. Now let us consider. Excuse me. Now let us consider whether the power of making treaties is not as securely placed as it was before. It was formerly vested in Congress, who were a body constituted by the legislatures of the different states in equal proportions. At present, it is vested in the president, who is chosen by the people of America, and in a Senate, whose members are chosen by the state legislatures, each legislature choosing two members. Surely there is a greater security in vesting this power as the present Constitution has vested it than in any other body.
Could I get you to pause?
Sure.
Right there was an insight to the Electoral College. The choosing of the president, right? At present, it is vested in a president who is chosen by the people of America and in a Senate. So when they say the people of America, when we go back and we look at the Electoral College was the choice of the people, not the state legislatures. So any of those states that were actually conducting or choosing the Electoral College for their people was a removal of the people's voice in the choosing of the president. Does that make sense?
Okay, I didn't see this coming, so let me see. Any of those states, repeat that, if you don't mind, one more time.
Okay, so the Electoral College was designed as in a representative government that the people were to choose the Electoral College. When you read that and you understand that this is a representative of the people because it's right there in tandem with the representatives. In other words, it's in Article 1, Section 1, I think, or 2, where they talk about representatives. The next, you know, section is the Senate and, you know, what they do. So the electors are in with the representatives of the people. And so they have the same standards, you know, for selection. They have to be 25 years of age, a U.S. citizen, blah, blah, blah. And so right here, he's basically pointing to the process of choosing the election or the choosing of the president is left to the American people and in a Senate whose members are chosen by the state legislatures. So he just divided this, you know, how our this federal government was being selected because the Senate was chosen. In other words, the state legislature determined the outcome of who was in the Senate. The concept that the state legislature would determine the outcome of who would become the president. So we're going into break on this, but I think I finally made that point to make the connecting of these dots. So when we come back from break, I'd like to hear your point, or you'd like to see if you see this epiphany of how we can find these little comments that really provide a clarity on an issue that you never even saw it being an issue here, just like what I just did. So forgive me. Forgive me for doing this, but we're going into break. We'll be right back after this. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So literally in one sentence, he creates the, you know, just a concise layout of how the choosing of the president was to be, not by a democracy of a direct election, because we understand that this Constitution had electors. Now,
okay.
Go ahead.
So even though he says it's chosen by the people of America, the process in the Constitution, which they are planning to use, means that that selection process is by the Electoral College.
Right. But see, what he reveals is who chooses their electors. And he's revealing that it's the people. Remember, I sent you, so folks, you don't know this,
yes.
But I sent Paul a whole bunch of links that laid out how the Electoral College was exercised from the very first presidential election up until, I think, 1832. And so when you look at how it ended up in 1832, all states but one had the people choose their electors. Now, there was never a point in time where they had an election with all of the people's names on it. So, folks, you got to understand that these men didn't say some of the obvious things that you're not thinking, or I'm not trying to insult you, but what people are trying to get you to ignore. How was a president, a sitting president, able to campaign by traveling around this vast republic with the means of transportation that they had? They didn't have airplanes. It took days to travel through a state just to get to one end of the state to get your county seat. It took a day. Your county to get to the other side of the state, it would take a week, if not more. And so it was not even fathomable that a person could actually run an effective campaign. An elector was the person who became your campaign manager for that congressional district. And so they would go, vote for me because I'm with Madison. Vote for me because I'm with Doofus Biden. And so that, and there were no primaries. Everybody was open, and you vote for the elector. So however many of people that were in the race, and as a matter of fact, the electors determined who would make the best vice president. There were no one was actually running as vice president. They were all running for president, and the electors chose who would be the president and who would be the vice president. Does that make sense now?
Sure.
Okay. All right, because this is really important, because this, you know, this popular vote crap and all of these other things, when we're looking at the Electoral College, you know, anybody that thinks that the state legislatures could choose the outcome, and why is this so important? As a Constitution Party member, you need to understand, when I say that the state legislature does not have the authority to determine the outcome of the presidential election, how is the presidential election being done? How is the outcome being determined? It is being determined. It was determined a long time ago, and it is still being maintained by the state legislature in giving the parties the choice of choosing their electors instead of you, the people, choosing your elector. Now, does that make sense? Even better? Is it more clear? Is it more better?
That's what's happening.
Am I helping? Is this helping? In this one sentence, I mean, as you read, things like this pop to me. And I go, oh, okay, that right there is really powerful. So I actually highlighted it, of course, in my own cryptic way. But nevertheless, when we look at our Electoral College today, there are so many different things that are being applied that are not within the people choosing their president. You know, this winner takes all even disenfranchises those people that actually chose this elector.
Correct.
Right. And when we look at primaries of actually having the parties get rid of candidates that are good.
Which they do on a regular basis.
Yes. But see, the primary, it's okay for the party to have a primary at the state level. But for the presidential level, it should be considered illegal. It should be considered illegal. Now, I've mentioned to a brother of mine, I've mentioned to you, that we need a petition that actually does this. Because if we have this petition, and as a matter of fact, maybe going into the Atlanta Convention, this would be a very powerful petition. Because we can clearly see, you know, how the state legislatures, by just handing this over, abdicating their responsibility of making sure that the people had a fair and a proper way of choosing their elector, they just surrendered it to the parties.
To these two private clubs.
Well, yeah, primarily because they knew that would be the common outcome, because they were the prevailing parties at the time. Sure. And they made it impossible for third parties to come up.
Right.
And today it's even harder and harder. Right. Where a third party just becomes the spoiler. That's it for the most case. Especially in the presidential race.
Position. Sure. That's a position that they get put in. Right?
Right. So I apologize for this interruption. But to me, this was like, bing! And and this actually helps us kind of, you know, go back to the importance of this petition that I believe is really important. It helps place a better understanding for the people of really what happened January 20th and what's been happening for a long time. We've all been manipulated in thinking that our government, you know, before, you know, Biden or, you know, there were some problems, but wow, this is terrible. You know, it's been terrible for a long time, and we've just been living with this corruption. Anyway.
Right.
Anywho.
Okay. All right.
So surely there is a greater security in. That's where I interrupted. Yeah.
Surely there is a greater security in vesting this power as the present Constitution has vested it than in any other body. Would the gentleman vest it in the present alone? If he would, his assertion that the power we have granted was as dangerous as the power vested by Parliament in the proclamations of Henry VIII might have been perhaps warranted. Would he vest it in the House of Representatives? Can secrecy be expected in 65 members? The idea is absurd. Besides, their sessions will probably last only 2 or 3 months in the year. Therefore, on that account, they would be a very unfit body for negotiation. Whereas the Senate, from the smallness of its numbers, from the equality of power which each state has in it, from the length of time for which its members are elected, from the long sessions they may have without any great inconveniency to themselves or constituents, joined with the president, who is the federal head of the United States, form together a body in whom can be best and most safely vested the diplomatic power of the Union.
And now for Rogue Island. When I say rogue, I mean rogue, R-O-U-G-E. Go ahead.
Okay. Ask the citizens of Massachusetts if the Confederation protected them during the insurrection of Shays. Ask the crews of our vessels captured by the Algerines if respect for our government hath softened the rigors of their captivity. Inquire of our delegates to Congress if all the dispatches from Republican ministers are not filled with lamentations of the imbecility of Congress, and whether foreign nations do not declare they can have no confidence in our government because it has not power to enforce obedience to treaties. Go through each state in the Union and be convinced that a disregard for law hath taken the place of order, and that Congress is so slighted by all of them that not one have complied with her requisitions. Every state in the Union except Rhode Island was so thoroughly convinced that our government was inadequate to our situation that all except her sent members to the convention at Philadelphia. General Pinckney said it had been alleged that when there, they exceeded their powers. He thought not. They had a right, he apprehended, to propose anything which they imagined would strengthen the Union and be for the advantage of our country. But they did not pretend to a right to determine finally upon anything. The present Constitution is but a proposition which the people may reject. But he conjured them to reflect seriously before they did reject it, as he did not think our state would obtain better terms by another convention, and the anarchy which would in all probability be the consequence of rejecting this Constitution would encourage some daring despot to seize upon the government and effectively deprive us of our liberties. Every member who attended the convention was, from the beginning, sensible of the necessity of giving greater powers to the federal government. This was the very purpose for which they were convened. The delegates of Jersey and Delaware were at first averse to this organization, but they afterwards acquiesced to it. And the conduct of their delegates has been so very agreeable to the people of these states that their respective conventions have unanimously adopted the Constitution. As we have found it necessary to give very extensive powers to the federal government, both over the persons and estates of the citizens, we thought it right to draw one branch of the legislature immediately from the people, and that both wealth and numbers should be considered in the representation.
Okay, so obviously there's another little hidden message there in what we were reading, and that had to do with the commission, where there was this parallel message that right. General Pinckney clearly articulated that they did not exceed, because he was one of them, they did not exceed their commission, that they actually went in and only Rogue Island was the one that wasn't there. So anyway, it's another little, side note of the fact that what they did was they did what they had to do to create a government that would sustain, I would just say the ebb and flow of, both, the poster or the prosperity and the successes, as well as the hardships that we were going to face as a nation. Mm-hmm. And it has. Okay, so now we get into apportionment, and this is, some special music. I should have been able to cue up some trumpets. Da 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 da. Da. Anyway, okay. Now we get into the part where they actually lay out the apportionment based on population at the time, and now you can kind of see that there were, Massachusetts was a very large state in population, so. At the top, it was New Hampshire was 102,000 people, so that they would get so many delegates. Massachusetts had 360, based on, for every 30,000, you get a representative. Rhode Island was at 58, so they would have only gotten one representative. You have to be at 60 to get two. And Connecticut was at 200, New York was at 233, so even New York wasn't that big of a player other than its commerce, its port. Its capability of moving traffic. New Jersey, 138. Pennsylvania, 360. So it was just like Massachusetts. It was, a big hitter. And then the biggest hitter of all was Virginia, 420. I don't want to skip over Delaware at 37. Now, South Carolina was 150. So they had five representatives, and Georgia had three with 90. So based on all of this, you can kind of see how they're actually, you see what they're saying here, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia is where the 3/5 rules were applied. Now you see why this is important, because this is where the application of the 3/5 rule was applied. It wasn't just applied in all states. And so they were calculating out of these 5 states, but they had already mentioned that Maryland already forbade the importation of slaves. So they were already moving towards an abolition state. And Virginia had already created in their constitution the wordage to do so. So now that kind of just left Delaware. In other words, Delaware was, the one state that was close. It was kind of in between. I don't know if you knew this. Have you ever traveled through Delaware?
So the last time
I went through Delmarva, you know what Delmarva is, right?
I've heard of Delmarva.
Yeah, the Delmarva is the peninsula where Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware kind of, occupy. And when you travel through that, principally like you're in Maryland and so forth, you really can't tell between, one state and the other. And what is prevalent there, what I remember it's been decades ago, but there were cotton fields in all three of those states.
Okay.
And so anyway, I just figured I'd, spice it up a little bit by giving you this information.
So apparently, I think we had a discussion maybe within the last 2 weeks. Delaware was also considered a slave state.
Yeah, it was.
It doesn't have any apportionment here for Negroes.
Well, so to be honest, it didn't matter. Because maybe that was one of the reasons why they just didn't even apply the rule, because they weren't even close to 60,000 to get the second representative.
Right. Sure.
So maybe that's why it wasn't there. But right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So now we obviously, because of slavery being such an issue in South Carolina, we're down a little bit. This is where Charles Coatworth Pinckney goes on about slavery. He says, blah.
Okay,
go ahead.
Here we go.
Oh, Paul.
Just
to avoid, the ending abruptly hitting us, we got 11 minutes right now. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Till the break?
To the end of till the break and at the end of the show, correct.
The end of the show?
Yeah, end of the show.
Thanks. The general then said he would make a few observations on the objections which the gentleman had thrown out on the restrictions that might be laid on the African trade after the year 1808. On this point, your delegates had to contend with the religious and political prejudices of the Eastern and Middle states and with the interested and inconsistent opinion of Virginia, who was warmly opposed to our importing Negroes more slaves. I am of the same opinion now as I was 2 years ago when I used the expressions the gentleman has quoted, that while there remained 1 acre of swampland uncleared in South Carolina, I would raise my voice against restricting the importation of Negroes. I'm as thoroughly convinced as that gentleman is that the nature of our climate and the flat, swampy situation of our country obliges us to cultivate our lands with Negroes, and that without them, South Carolina would soon be a desert waste.
Keep going.
You have so frequently heard my sentiments on this subject that I need not now repeat them. It was alleged by some of the members who opposed an unlimited importation that slaves increased the weakness of any state who admitted them, that they were a dangerous species of property, which an invading enemy could easily turn against ourselves and the neighboring states, and that as we were allowed a representation for them in the House of Representatives, our influence in government would be increased in proportion as we were less able to defend ourselves. Quote, show some period, end quote, said the members from the eastern states, when it might be in our power to put a stop, if we please, to the importation of this weakness. And we will endeavor for our convenience to restrain the religious and political prejudices of our people on this subject, end quote. The Middle States of Virginia made us no such proposition. They were for an immediate and total prohibition. We endeavored to obviate the objections that were made in the best manner we could and assigned reasons for our insisting on the importation, which there is no occasion to repeat, as they must occur to every gentleman in the House, A committee of the states was appointed in order to accommodate this matter, and after a great deal of difficulty, it was settled on the footing recited in the Constitution. By this settlement, we have secured an unlimited importation of Negroes for 20 years. Nor is it declared that the importation shall be then stopped. It may be continued. We have a security that the general government can never emancipate them, for no such authority is granted. And it is admitted on all hands that the general government has no powers but what are expressly granted by the Constitution, and that all rights not expressed were reserved by the several states. We have obtained a right to recover our slaves in whatever part of America they may take refuge, which is a right we had not before. In short, considering all circumstances, we have made the best terms for the security of this species of property it was in our power to make. We would have made better if we could, but on the whole, I do not think them bad.
Go ahead. I expect comment now.
Yeah, so he said something interesting here, and I don't remember the provisions of the Confederation. It didn't try to restrict slavery, but it's said here that we now have the ability to extract our slaves from any state they might.
Yeah. So that's in Article 4. If a person runs away from one state, escaping involuntary servitude or, you know, labor, I think they use don't use slave, but I think the circumstances of labor, of involuntary servitude. But anyway, that state needs to hand over that person. So this is why when Wisconsin, and you got to remember that the Northwest Ordinance covered Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, right? That large area of expanse. And so these states, when they came into the Union, and, you know, their little guide coming into the Union was the Northwest Ordinance, that slavery was to be stopped there, that, you know, it was not to end, you know, not to be there. And so they actually had the paradigm of being abolition states and were actually really anti-slavery, because in the Northwest Ordinance, it kind of identified that, you know, slavery is not cool. And so, so bottom line, you know, the sentiment was growing, and I'm just telling you that as the new states started joining, look, so I'm going to go to it. So forgive me for pulling up, you know, the statehood order. But when you look at who joined the state, it was Vermont was the first state to join, right? And then it was Kentucky, and then Tennessee, which happened to be close, you know, a part of Virginia and a part of North Carolina. And then we had Ohio, Louisiana, Indiana, Mississippi, Illinois, Alabama, Maine, and then Missouri. So they were kind of introducing them, and they were still seeing a reduction and the propensity of losing slaves.
Okay.
And so they, at this point in time, before Missouri, they said, you know what? If we don't invoke slave states, or, you know, basically mandate slave states on a certain amount of states coming in, we will lose slavery. They will amend it out of the Constitution, as it was predicted both in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania.
That was the idea.
Right. That was the idea. And so they had to create this shift in paradigm that the federal government could now start imposing. So when the Western states want to understand how they've lost their equal footing, how the federal government, you know, manipulated so much of their land away from them and everything else, the door got cracked open by these greedy plantation owners of the South and, you know, trying to protect their little fiefdom. Does that make sense?
Was that how we got the Missouri Compromise?
That's how we got the Missouri Compromise. You remember, you and I have talked about this on several occasions, how the Missourians, the people of Missouri did not want slavery. It was only the affluent that happened to move there that wanted it. And because they commanded, you know, I'll just say the influence, they created a perception, but had they actually went into a convention, you know as well as I do, because they even declared Dred Scott a free man. The people of Missouri.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
What do you mean, had they actually went into a convention?
Had they gone into the convention with the ability to choose for themselves whether they be a free state or not, I believe the rich men that wanted slave states, they didn't feel comfortable enough that they could persuade these people to create Missouri as a slave state. Because remember, Missouri was basically pulled together by the counties and the counties' interest. And it wasn't in the interest of all of the counties. Missouri's kind of a diverse land. It's got some flat lands, it's got mountains and other areas, so these counties had different interests. And
I'll tell you.
Right. You live there, so you tell me about Missouri. So when we look at there was a big risk that these people that were moving there, that were, you know, moving slaves there and everything else, that they wanted to be a slave state. They needed it to be a slave state. And so instead of allowing the natural, you know, selection by the people to choose, they basically did an end run and got their other fellow slave states and the jurists and everybody else that were already sitting, that were pro-slavery throughout the United States, to all kind of look at and basically accept this concept of a Missouri Compromise of inflicting slavery upon new states coming into the Union. That's how the Civil War had to be fought, because the Lord's plan in the Constitution was really to basically get rid of slavery. It was repugnant. I've said this several times, and I think I said it on Monday, that when you look at the commandment to leave the Garden of Eden and Adam, that all men were to live by the sweat of their brow.
Sure.
Well, slavery alleviates that. It violates that one commandment.
I'm going to explore this at some point on my own a little more. But
yeah, we've got less than a minute, 30 seconds.
Okay, many states had conventions. Sounds like Missouri had their Enabling Act altered before their convention.
Well, the Missouri Compromise, they were holding off on Maine and Missouri. They didn't do the Enabling Acts until they came up with the Compromise. The Compromise was first, then they did the Enabling Act.
Wow.
Yep. And so Missouri's, you know, the die was cast that America would have to fight the Civil War. So, folks, we've got to get going. I thank you so much for joining us, Paul. And as we hear the intro music, we can't hear Paul anymore, I apologize. But he will be back next week to actually read some more. But I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we really need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.